I got this rolling now.
Okay.
And the introduction, Paul Rodell, this is, again, another IBS Oral History Project interview. It is evening. It is the 23rd, I think.
It is.
Okay.
August?
Yeah, of August. I'm sorry. Yes, of August. Thank you. I'm here with Stephen Green. Do you prefer Stephen or Steve?
Steve's whatever.
Steve, you go. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't really absolutely sure, because when you see it written out...
I always sign my name Stephen, so yeah.
Yeah, but I thought I heard Connie call you Steve,
mm-hmm.
You know,
totally.
Or she referred to you as that. Anyway, so Steve Green and I are sitting in his living room, and it's the 23rd of August. Steve was in Laos from June of 1964 through June of 1966 with IVS, and we'll get into all of what he did in various RD assignments in different places throughout the country. And we may actually just dribble over into a little bit of your continued life in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
Some people have said, you know, I worked for AID and I did this and that, and, you know, kind of a taking you from your IVS experience to show its impact on the rest of your life. But starting off with a real beginning, I mean like birth, literally, if you could say where and when you were born and who your parents were and where they brought you up, what kind of upbringing did they give their son Stephen? And what were the influences on you that got you to the point where you joined IVS, or you considered even something like IVS? And take it away, and I'll chirp in to redirect
keep you on keel and stuff like that. Fine, yeah.
But mostly we're interested in the person's own document.
Okay, I was born in Iowa, in Northwest Iowa. In a town called Sioux Rapids, 1942. Both my parents were farm people, and I was the fourth child in a family that was already on the farm and so on. The town that I grew up in, or the farm next to the town, was about 230 people. And
a big one.
Yeah, big town. But it had its own school, and basically I would say it was a village, or town, in the sense that probably most of things that we needed we could get from that town.
Really?
Those things surrounded the school and that sort of thing. The churches were in, there were two churches in the town and that sort of thing. So basically a very homogeneous German, Northern European, Lutheran,
mm-hmm.
Methodist sort of background. A couple of Catholic families.
Mm-hmm.
In the area, but pretty much that. Lived there for 18 years. In the middle of my junior year, my parents moved to bought a farm down by Des Moines, Iowa. So I graduated from high school, not at this small school,
mm-hmm.
or not at a small town called Rembrandt, Iowa. But
Rembrandt?
Rembrandt, Iowa.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And moved down to a town just north of... or a farm by the town down north of Des Moines.
But they continued farming.
Oh, yes, and they bought the farm, and that was a great thing, because prior to that they'd been renting.
Oh, okay, that's a big step.
This is a big step, and it was a traumatic thing. So all of my siblings had already left to go to school. We all went to college. We were all expected to go to college. I was a junior, and we started working on the farm down there and cleaning it up and so on. We built a house the first year down there just because the old house was pretty
mm-hmm.
shot, and my uncle built it for us, and we worked on it.
Yeah.
It was a sweat equity type of thing and so
uh-huh.
on. So I graduated from high school from North Polk Community School and went off to the next fall, went to Graceland College, which is a church school of a Latter-day Saint in southern Iowa. It was a junior college at that time.
Oh, uh-huh.
So that's where my mom had gone, and And so it was a pretty real small campus, probably 700-800 students. Graduated from there as a sophomore, an associate arts degree, which is normal. Then went to.
Was it a 2-year thing?
It was 4-year in some areas. It has now become a 4-year in all areas.
Oh, okay.
So it was in a transition there. But at the time, most of the stuff was in the 2-year category.
Okay. Because so I don't know this school. I haven't heard of it.
It's in Lamoni, Iowa. It's right on the Missouri border.
Okay.
Yep. And transferred from there as a junior to Iowa, University of Iowa, and graduated from the University of Iowa in 1964.
Okay.
In June of 1964.
What kind of degree?
A degree in general science, math, science type thing, and didn't do my practical teaching. But if I'd done that, I'd have a teaching certificate. I was originally in a pre-med curriculum, and that's what I studied. And I was a walk-on in the baseball, played baseball at Rembrandt all the time, and made the team, and was on scholarship down there and stuff as a walk-on, which is really unusual. So decided to do my senior year rather than go to medical school. And did my senior year, really didn't have anything to do except to get the credits to graduate, because I'd satisfied all the stuff for pre-med by my end of my junior year type of thing. And really enjoyed myself in many respects. My sister was married to the chief of party of IVS in Laos and had married him a couple of years earlier when he was here in the United States and had taken that position because he'd been an IVSer back in the late 50s.
And this was?
Walt Coward.
Okay.
And my sister Rose. He then accepted a position with the IVS chief of party position and went to Laos. And my sister wrote to me sometime during the my senior year and asked me if I didn't have plans, that this was really an opportunity. She was really enjoying herself, thought I should look into it. I wrote to IVS Washington. They assumed that Walt knew that he could place me somewhere, even though they weren't after science teachers and math teachers and that sort of thing, but basically allowed me or recruited me on the basis of my farm background.
And the ability, farm background
and my ability to, you know, to land on my feet in a sense in terms of problem solving, that sort of thing. In fact, it was right on.
Yeah.
I really had no problems. When I was in Laos, I was assigned, you know, to a cluster program and so on. And I'll talk about that.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. But
yeah.
First, were your parents disappointed that you went into, or that you were headed toward a non-agriculture degree?
I don't think so.
They didn't necessarily look for.
No, there wasn't any. There was no push. My one brother is a professor at a university down in Iowa. My sister is a farm person, but she was originally a teacher. And my sister Rose, who was in Laos, was a nurse.
Okay.
So what we wanted to do, and you know, my parents are, you know, super parents in every way in that sense. I mean, they really felt no pressure to choose
go anywhere.
I could go where I wanted, yeah.
Okay.
And I don't remember them ever being surprised, particularly about choosing to say go to Southeast Asia for a few years or anything like that. And they're very understanding about that. So I don't remember it ever being an issue. So by the time I graduated from the university, they had a program of recruits that was being assembled in Washington at the end of June. And so I graduated something like the second week in June, and I was
gone.
Yeah. Well, so it was really fascinating.
This is interesting that you had, you know, the personal touch, you know, through your sister.
Yeah.
So this familial sort of approach. And certainly if she would write and say, I think you'll like this, that's a strong influence. But there had to be, I would suppose, that there had to be something that attracted you to it, more than just your sister's recommendation. You might have been inclined to say, hey, I think she's right on the money. Is there anything in your background that disposed you to go overseas in service? Well, yes, sir,
yeah.
Sort of thing?
Good. That's really insightful of you, because when we were, when I was probably about 8 or 9, we had foreign exchange students stay with us for a time. It was foreign service. Stayed for a few months with different families.
Uh-huh.
And this fellow was from Burma.
Ooh.
His name was Tian, and you know, it was, I still remember him very well, and we used to play chopsticks together on the telephone. He was always going out, and he was here for a summer, and he went around, and we drove tractors and all that kind of stuff, and he helped on the farm and stuff. My mom kept in touch with him for quite a while afterwards, so I knew of places outside of, you know, this little area in northwest Iowa very well.
Uh-huh.
And then earlier than that, I think maybe later than that, this was in the 50s, maybe 49 or something, the folks through the Lutheran Church brought over, sponsored a Latvian family.
Oh, okay.
Just at the time when Russia had
was gobbling that all up.
So yeah. Those people were refugees that had come into Germany, I think it was, or someplace anyway. They were looking for places. And so a family of Latvians came and lived in our, and he worked as a hired man on our farm. For like 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, they spoke no English, and it was, you know, I remember them well. I mean, that was another example of or exposure in the sense that there are other things out there.
Yeah, and you could really be in the northwest corner of Iowa, in the heartland.
Yeah.
And you still have this international experience.
Right.
Washing over
very
from time
so.
To time.
Very
yeah.
much so. So as a, and then when I went to Graceland College, one of my roommates was a Japanese. So
not Japanese American.
No, Japanese,
but a foreign
from Japan.
Student.
Yeah, his name was Yoshiyasu Yoshida.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he would get these packages from home, which were exotic as hell in terms of what you would enjoy as well.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It was really amazing, all the dried squid and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he would always share. We were very close.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good experience. You know, I mean, it was good for me because I already knew those things and stuff, and we were close. And when I was a junior at University of Iowa, I lived with an Egyptian. He was studying in oral surgery at the University of Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
He was going back from Alexandria. And as a senior, I lived with a Chinese fellow whose parents lived in Laos. His family lived in Laos.
Uh-huh. So they were, they had immigrated?
They had immigrated. They had a shop there and they lived in, yeah. In fact, it was one of the most interesting things about myself and about that situation and that whole, to give a feel for that, is that he gave me over $700 in cash to take back to his family.
Uh-huh.
And said, here's the address. And I got it and I made it into traveler's checks and I took and I looked them up 2 weeks after I was in Vientiane and gave it to them.
Uh-huh.
And he said Mike was his nickname, I don't remember what his last name was. Mike said you would become, you know, and I wrote traveler's checks, endorsed them over to him and left, and he said if you ever need anything in Laos, please come and see us. You know, this family is your family, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I took that as being, yeah, well, Mike was a really neat guy. He ate a little strange things. Cat brains eggs and stuff.
Yeah.
But so there really is a precedence for having lived with and been around people of different cultures and so on. I attribute that in part to my parents who were willing to take those kinds of risks, and I think they were in an area like that. So yes, definitely, that was it was not, I saw it as an adventure. I saw the whole IVS opportunity as an adventure, not something that I would seek as a career, but something that would be a good thing to do. And I looked at realizing that I was burned out of school and college and that sort of thing, and wanted to, you know, do a little looking around before maybe going back to medical school or some such thing.
Yeah.
So it really did fit in with my plans, and I'm always in debt to my sister for having written to me and the way that
cued
she did.
You in on
yeah,
one.
She just kind of said, take a look at it, and here's the address, and I think you'd like it. And so that...
Because this is by 60 what?
64.
By 64.
This is probably the spring, or fall of 63. This would be my senior year.
Okay.
And I graduated June of 64.
So it seems like a lot, you know, it really seems like a lot of family influence.
Not
only because it's your sister writing, but you also mentioned that it was your parents bringing over
right.
the Latvians.
Oh, all the way.
And welcoming the foreign exchange students, et cetera, et cetera. And it's also interesting that it was from Asia, North Africa, and Europe, not just one region.
Yeah, it's just a potpourri of exposure and stuff. I mean, it was just, there's clearly that. And I think through that was a general respect for the differences that these people exhibited and what an opportunity it was and how meaningful they were. I mean, it was not, there was no overriding purpose to this. It was just the way things should be. And you meet people and you know that they're going to be different, and so you hang out with these people so that they can tell you how about yourself at the same thing. Cause you can
and
see
because you expect that it's going to be different, you respect the difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it goes with the territory. I mean, the small Iowa farm is, or the small Iowa community is really that. I mean, that's the, you just, everybody looked out for everybody there. I mean, you couldn't get away with anything in that town because somebody
yes,
would
I
say,
know.
Somebody would say, aren't you Cliff Green's boy? And he'd say, yes, oh, you know, well, I don't think he'd approve of that. And so that's, you know, that's saying.
Yeah, I was always Gus Rodell's boy, and I grew up in a town of 3,500.
Yeah.
You know.
And we'd been there in the
Which
whole
is a little
family.
Bit bigger,
they
but still, they knew.
My grandparents immigrated to that area, so it's like they set up the town, and not they, but I mean groups
the
of
part
people
of
like
the,
them. Yeah.
Part of the lifeblood.
An
of
integral
it.
Part of the beginning of that small community and so on. So, and at the same time, when I left there, I had the opportunity to stay with my grandmother my senior year. And I opted not to do that. I decided to move in the middle of my junior year down to this new place. And I did it because I wanted something different. I remember making that decision. I remember being offered that. I remember my parents, or at least my father, being kind of dismayed by the fact that I wouldn't want to stay there and graduate from the smalls. Because my grandmother lived right across from the school, that kind of thing. It would have been easy. And I grew up with this whole class, very stable class, in terms of the, not much people coming in and going out, the same people I started school with, ended. But what happened was that I just wanted, you know, bigger. I was classified as a C student in this school, and there was no backing off that type of thing. The curriculum was small in relationship to the, and I did want to go to college and so on, and this new school had chemistry and advanced math classes that Vingren did not have. And so I saw that as an opportunity. In fact, the teacher down there was so influential in that year and a half that I actually did a chemistry degree when I went on to college. I mean, I was an A student down there. So I got all A's.
Yeah.
Everything, and I worked very hard, and I never worked at Rembrandt, that kind of thing. So I had looked for it as a new beginning in a sense, and it worked out. And I was able to, you know, it really was a springboard for, you know, my aspirations for going to school and that sort of thing. It was closer to Des Moines. It was a bigger, you know, metropolitan area, obviously.
Yeah.
I liked that aspect of it. It was just an opportunity, and also because I knew that the parents would need somebody to sort of break ground. And school is a great way to do that, so it gave them an opportunity to meet people through the school activities that I was involved in, and I knew that was going to be necessary too. So this is a family, and we're going to stay together as a family, and so on. And there was a lot of work to do on the farm because I'd seen the farm and the house. Clearly couldn't be lived in and wouldn't be fixed, and we'd need to build a new one, and the place was really run down, and that's why we were able to afford it, that sort of thing. So it looked to me like the future lay there, not in you know, going back and say, hanging on to some graduation thing. Even though my father and all my other siblings had graduated from Rembrandt,
yeah,
that wasn't a big deal for me.
So no, but you wanted to stay with your parents.
Well, I wanted to move on, too.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw that as their opportunity to, you know, to buy a farm. It was a pretty big deal.
Oh, no, that is a big deal.
You know, and we were moving all our stuff down there, and we had just enormous amounts of work to do on the farm, building mm-hmm. fences, taking up trash, and it was pretty run down.
Yeah.
So then I, in the fall, after my senior year, I went to Grayson, like I said, and went through 4 years, basically, of school. And came home each summer and worked on the farm and did the farming. My dad, at that time, to make payments and stuff like that, had taken a second job or a first
mm-hmm.
job.
Mm-hmm.
Second job after farming in a Massey Ferguson plant.
He did.
He did. And so it was, you know, and I asked him if I could come back, so it was a mutual thing for me to come back and work in the summer. So mm-hmm. I did that every summer, at least for 3 summers, between my freshman and junior
yeah.
year, junior and senior year. So, and that worked out pretty good. It was not a big deal. So then sailed into, you know, into IVS and met with those folks out in Washington for a 2-week orientation in which we were welcomed to the great ship IVS. And
the teeny little vessel that it was.
Yeah, I mean it was an amazing send off, and we were very I would say very idealistic and very hopeful about the experience. And I remember dropping the first team. We went into Tokyo. But and
before you go on though,
yeah.
Why not Peace Corps?
Well, Peace Corps had offered in, you know, meetings and that sort of thing at Iowa to mm-hmm. recruit people. And I think it was the pitch as much as anything. And the pitch was something about the fact that what will Peace Corps do for you in terms of, you know, once you finish your tour, that kind of thing. I think the enthusiasm, or at least the experience of the people who were recruiting, had been just back from Peace Corps. I think they were from Africa. They'd been in Africa, and they just couldn't say enough about what a wonderful experience it was. The idea of, not sure, because that was in that same period of time. My sister wrote somewhat later, but I think uh-huh. I was interested just to hear what they had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been just whether I was willing to take the risk to go into a large organization like that at this point in time, and I'm not sure that that might not have been, you know, some small part of that, just saying, you know, could I do that? It was much easier later when Rose wrote to me and said, well, why don't you come over there, which is less of a risk because they're there. I don't know.
Because it's familial?
Because she was there already, you know. Yeah.
So there's family?
Family is certainly a factor.
And the organization's small and intimate?
When I first got in contact with them and they wrote to me and stuff, John Hughes was the recruiter at that time, and John is a very personable type person, always managed to write something personal on there and said something about Walt and so on, and how pleased they were. And yes, that's,
mm-hmm.
it was like, this is not threatening at all, this is not, you know, I didn't have goals at that time other than going to medical school, which I was postponing, so in a sense it was like, what should I do? And it was just so damned exciting. I still can remember the sort of the thrill
yeah.
of not knowing what I'm going to do, but just willing to go. And, so,
and anticipating whatever.
Right. And my brother had gone in the Marines,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't have any interest in going in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him to buy me some Marine fatigues. Not they were just tans
uh-huh.
at that time. So he got me a bunch of those kinds of clothes and sent them to me, and that's what I was going to wear over there and that sort of thing. In turn, there was no insignia on them or anything like that.
Yeah,
just tan stuff. So it just kind of fit into place. I wasn't seriously involved with anybody and hadn't been, and in fact didn't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Any relationships with I had a steady girlfriend at the time, and this. It was like I had things to do. It
yeah.
was in my mind that I just wasn't ready to settle down, and that was well before I had, you know, been in contact with, talked to Peace Corps people, or had talked to my sister. My sister Ray. So there was something about just wanting to see the world.
Yeah, something of a wanderlust.
Clearly
there.
An adventure.
Yeah.
It wasn't to escape. It wasn't a goal.
Uh-huh.
It was just something that sounded like it would be fantastic. And it was.
Yeah.
In every way. If I could have written expectations at that time about what I could have expected, this far exceeded anything.
Uh-huh.
In terms of my exposure to, you know, living conditions, the whole American involvement,
uh-huh.
the immensity of the American government and its ability to put stuff on the ground at any given point in terms of getting its, was just all, you know, overwhelming, very mm-hmm. heady stuff.
So. But you go out with this little group of people.
Mm-hmm. And we had people from Vietnam and from Laos.
Uh-huh.
And you're saying half the team was Vietnam and half the team was Laos. And after our two-week thing in Harper's Ferry, then we all traveled together and went through Tokyo together. And I think, yeah, we went through Hong Kong as well. And we had a good mm-hmm. time. Then we dropped off the people. We spent one night. Let's see, did we? I think not. I think that they just changed planes there. We might have ridden an Air Lao
mm-hmm.
flight from Hong Kong, which went through Cambodia, Vietnam, went through Vietnam, Cambodia, and then up to Laos. Mm-hmm. I remember stopping in Phnom Penh and taking a picture of a Massey Ferguson tractor that was sitting there because that's where my dad worked.
sending him the picture.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So then we went, we dropped off the volunteers in Saigon and then we went up to Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we flew quite low and we could see the rice paddies and all this kind of stuff below. And this one fellow that was with me, John Scully, and I were sitting there by the window. I was wondering which village we're going to be in. And we weren't even in Laos yet. We were still in Cambodia. That kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So we got into Vientiane and, you know, people that were there already met us.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, it was almost surreal in terms of this business. You know, here's this strange place. Well, we'd been in Tokyo, so that was strange.
Uh-huh.
But this was like, you know, here we are, we're here, and yet there's all these familiar people in terms of Americans that are looking out. The organization, there were no surprises because they were expecting us.
Uh-huh.
And so the adventure wasn't, you know, it was like being on a really well-organized tour where, uh-huh. look at this, look at this, look at this.
Uh-huh.
And so we were well cared for. We had billets that we were going to. We had a hostel that we were going to, and it wasn't very far from the American compound. And it was very sort of like a reunion type or camp type experience initially. And they had it all laid out. They were going up to Luang Prabang, which is the northern capital, to spend 6 weeks, I think it was, in language training.
Oh, okay.
That sort of thing. We went
this
up
would
there.
Have been about when?
This was probably in July.
In July, okay.
Yeah, it was just right after we arrived. It was just a week or so that we were there.
Okay.
And we were sent right up there. Galen Barry was in country already, and he was sort of in charge of giving us. I think there probably were 12 of us in there, a big group.
Who were they?
Huh?
Do you remember who they were?
Yeah, quite a few. Yeah, I was saying there was Terry Collins and John Scully, and. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned Scully.
Right. Yeah. Linda Driscoll mm-hmm. was going to the, she was home economics, which typical at that time, that's all women could be.
That's
you
right,
know, that
yeah.
kind of thing. Chip Smith, Richard Smith was his mm-hmm. name, who was an excellent linguist and, you know, learned the language really quickly. Gary Haynes, who was a good friend of mine and was killed in an automobile accident back in the States after he finished his tour over there. He was in irrigation. Trying to think. There obviously were others. Maybe it was about 10 people or so, but it was a pretty good sized group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe. And Bob Logan was in there.
Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, I spent a certain amount of that time in the language training being sick. I had dysentery, and I don't know that I had dysentery. I think I had a certain amount of diarrhea and that sort of thing.
Welcome to Asia.
Yeah, exactly. And it didn't seem to be getting better, and I was losing weight quite rapidly, and everybody thought I was homesick. you know. It may have to be said home. Galen Berry, I guess, was sending things to my brother-in-law, Walt, about the fact that everybody's doing real well except Steve Green. He seems to be really homesick and all this kind of stuff. And in fact, I had bloody stools. And I was so sick and feeling so terrible that I just could hardly operate. But interesting, and Galen, you know, he deserves this shot at him, but he took us, and he thought, you know, good old Bien Chun guy he was, that this training should be, you know, we should be given the most Spartan meal ticket possible. It didn't cost us much at all, because it was like $10 a month or something like this, and this guy put on just terrible meals. It's the worst food that I ever ate in Laos, and it was totally unappetizing. And unknown to us, I mean, this is how programmed and sheltered this intro was, and so on, the way they were dealing with us, that down the street, less than a block away, was a Vietnamese-French restaurant. You could get hamburgers, beefsteak, French fries, the whole works, Pepsi. And, interestingly enough, John Doolittle came up and saw us, and he saw how sick I was, and he says, "You got to order something from the commissary." We said, "Commissary? What's that?" They hadn't told us about any of this stuff. We just thought this was the way it was going to be up there. So,
oh, man.
Is that something? Man, we just canceled our reservations at this restaurant, and we went off and ate. And by the time the training was over, I was back.
You were back up.
I gained about 15 pounds.
Sorry. Anyway.
That's right. Anyway, so what we did was we talked to Galen about this, and Galen says, "Well, I thought I should give you the most harsh intro you could possibly have, so that anything in the future would be really good." And
that's a dumb way to go about it.
It did seem so, yeah, and I never quite understood that. At any rate, when we got done with the language training, several of the people spoke really good Lao. I could barely speak the greeting.
You could barely what?
Speak the greeting.
Really?
Yes. Oh. Which is really simple. It's the same thing. I mean, if you were to greet somebody, you'd say, Sabai Di Ba, and they would say back to you, Koi Sabai Di. I am fine. You are fine? I am fine. You know, that kind of thing. I didn't know how to answer the teacher when I ran into him at the IVS office in Bien Chun. So, you know, you can see how my linguistic skills in a classroom were just about zero, and that was not effective, and I don't know, that was not the way to deal with me anyway.
But you did well in the language.
Absolutely, yeah. I suppose.
So how'd you really pick it up?
Well, I got into the village, and they sent an interpreter who was not a very good interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned with Chip Smith, who was very good. He picked up a lot of the language and was really studying it personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I was assigned, both Chip and I were assigned right at that time after the training to go down to La Compang, which is a small township, county seat type thing, right north of Pak Se in southern Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And Chip and I were assigned together down there. And this was USAID's program called the Cluster Program. And that the concept behind that was that AID wanted to set up time impact programs whereby you would work in little areas and they were that were potentially sort of bypassed and sort of isolated government type, isolated from the government thing. So we were located in La Compang, and about five villages fairly close by.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to focus our attention on those five villages and do what improvements we could in terms of what AID had to offer. And AID offered pig programs and duck programs and some ag programs, some animal husband programs in terms of vaccinations. They were doing schools, building schools, that kind of thing. And my farm background, we used to raise pigs all over the place down there. So
sure.
I said, let's do a cluster village garden so we raised, in fact, I made a trip to Thailand with one of the animal hus guys, Americans, volunteers from Vientiane. We went down and looked at these large purebred breeding places in Thailand,
mm-hmm.
where these pigs were going to be bought. And these were super hybrid Chester Whites, that sort of thing. Pretty much American type, long mm-hmm. and so on, you know, long and bacon-like. But anyway, we went down there.
Bacon-like.
They want the fat, is my point, you know. It's
yeah.
just the opposite of what generally they would like in a pig, because they want the fat to cook with and such sort of thing. But we were looking at that time toward leaner things. But anyway, as a help to the aid program in Thailand, we started buying their surplus animals, and aid was buying them up and wanting to know where they could be, so they were kind of pushing them also. Mm. So we were going to take and raise a couple of, maybe four pigs on this little village site in Lac Ompang and that sort of thing. And that was my project, and so we spent a lot of time building hog sheds and runs and planting gardens to get mungo seeds for protein sources and that kind of thing. And there just wasn't enough food in the area to do it, so I called my friend John Scully, who had been talking about these smut runs down in Kong Island off the Mekong River, and I said, John, I need some dried fish, or I need fish, I need something, protein for my pigs, can you help me? And he said, I think I can. And about a week later, a caribou, which is a transport plane, was dispatched from Kong Island to my site with a whole load of fish. Stink. Oh, rotten fish, you know what I mean? And we spent, I had to find out how to deal with them first, but basically we took and steam cooked them over a 55-gallon barrel with a real heavy mat on top of that with the water in the bottom, and we built fires and we steamed these fish to steam off some of that oil.
Uh-huh.
Which then allowed them, and we laid them out and dried them, and so we had our protein source, and we put them back in the bags that he had sent them up there with. And so I had all this protein, and so I was able to, you know, raise these pigs. You know. So what happened was that we had this upgrading of pig program, and we originally had, I farrowed a couple of litters, and we then were trying to select farmers in these cluster mm-hmm. villages to give these pigs to and so on. And that was a disaster because they ran into the same problem that we had. There's just not enough available in that area.
In terms of protein sources?
In terms of protein and food in the dry season, that sort of thing.
Oh,
in fact,
okay.
it really taxed some of the people immensely.
It was
a great burden to keep them because they really hadn't fed their local pigs mm-hmm. much. They were really excellent scavengers and so on.
Yeah.
And they were tough as nails, you know. In fact, they're the pigs that we're now bringing to this country as pets.
Yes,
which amazes me. They are tough.
Yeah.
So then we moved into, that was a disaster, and ended up, a lot of the pigs were so malnutritioned that they didn't even come into heat, so they would never even get a litter off of them. But the plan was that they should somehow be brought back to our site, and they would be bred back to this big boar I had there.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 400 pounds. That sucker was huge. And that only happened once, and there was really a small market for that kind of purebred pig because obviously people couldn't afford to raise
it up.
Yeah, exactly. And so then what we did is we went in and I started offering, just mating my big boar with the local
mm-hmm.
pigs and that sort of thing, and so that worked pretty well. And we stopped transporting my big boar because he always got sick whenever I threw him in my crate to take him down to the Jeep. So then we'd bring the female up when she was in heat and stuff. And that worked pretty good. And the only real downside on that particular program was the fact that we wiped out an existing program that was already going on. In other words, there were people, and one guy in particular that I know, who would come through periodically offering, leading his big Duroc, which is a great big red pig, for that same purpose, only, of course, he couldn't give it away, and we did. Mm-hmm. So without ever knowing it, we kind of put him out of business. At least he never came through that area. So that kind of thing went on, and we didn't realize that.
Or you were giving free sex.
Yeah, we were just this is good for everybody, good for relationships, pig relationships, everything. So then the language thing came in about that time, and that was the realization after I'd been down in the village about 6 months that if I was going to be able to do this program, I was going to have to learn the language.
Mm-hmm. Really learn it.
Really learn it. And it wasn't so much in the schooling that IVS had, was they had tied this sound like they would teach it in school. Mm-hmm. Here's the sound, here's how it looks, and here's what it is, and stuff like that. And I really, my education that I gave myself was simply, I need to know certain words, and I need to be able to speak about this, and I need to be able to build sheds, I need to know different kinds of wood, I need to know different kinds of feeds, I got these plants, what are these called? And Chip was very helpful in that, and was able to, because he had, Chip Smith was...
That's Richard Smith, right?
Correct. And he already had such a handle. I mean, if I needed to know a word, Dick, Chip already had it. And I learned about 300 words in about 3 weeks, 500 words, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I learned, the sequence of things. And by then, you can ask, how do you say this, and so on. And by then, I was on my way. And at the end of my tour, I probably spoke Lao as well as anybody that was there or ever had been there. Uh-huh. And I didn't read it. I couldn't read the phonetics or anything like that, but language as a result of that, which became such an enormous help, that it was just a continual thing as it continued, as I learned new things and so on. So it was I realized that myself. Motivation for continuing to study it and to continue to increase my vocabulary, it was just amazed at the response.
Oh, of the local people?
Of the local people and my ability to get... to show what I wanted to do there and all my ideas and so on like that. It was really a plus.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be nothing for me. At one time, Chip, for example, took his vacation time when I studied French in Vientiane. So I was down, and in the rainy season, I was down in Lacompagne for 3 months by myself. Mm-hmm. It rained most of the time. I never spoke English to anybody because there weren't any English. Yeah. The guy on the radio was Thai, so you speak Lao with him because he could understand Lao better than he could understand English to check in.
And especially your Thai.
Yeah. Well, I didn't have Thai at that time.
Exactly.
So I spoke Lao and he spoke good Lao. So, and we had to make a radio check on a short single sideband radio twice a day. We'd fire up our generator and just check in to make sure that we were up there and alive, and that would be reported back to Vientiane and so on. Wasn't much going on because of the rainy season. But I remember living there for 3 months in this language, just immersed in this language, and just doing what I did. And I don't remember, can't really count too much for that time, but it was quite an interesting time for me.
But not for work, it was more for language.
Well, yeah, there wasn't much you could
because
do.
Of the
land
rain
just
and
gets
stuff
beat.
Like that.
Yeah, just gets beat flat. There's no, and we had the vegetable garden and the pigs and stuff like that had to be taken care of during this time.
Right.
So
I just thought I would stop here for a second because Richard Smith, there was an IVS gave an address for him, but it came back. So it was the wrong address. So I don't know where.
He should be in Philadelphia someplace, is it?
Well, there's an address for Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And it didn't cut it.
So
he might have just moved within the city.
Yeah.
And I've got an old one or something like that.
Yeah. No, I understand. I haven't been in touch with him at all.
Yeah, but I was wanting to give that to you.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So you can surprise the heck out of him.
Yeah. But he was. He was a real linguist. Chip was from the city, and in some ways we got along really well, and others we didn't, because I was fairly. I mean, one of the realizations that I had about my village, or the village that we lived in, and it was a remarkable experience for me, I think it was for Chip as well, but it was particularly for me, was the fact that they would come over on religious days and tell us what was going on, and then tell us what to wear and tell us where to be, and we would go to the Wat for the temple for the religious experience, whether the young boys or the new young boys were being recruited or brought in or initiated or whatever it was, and we were told how to sit. We were told what gifts to bring, which were never gifts that we had. It was gifts that they would bring and give to us that we would give. It would be tokens of rice or some such thing. They were curious about us, but they were never prejudiced against us. They welcomed us. I have never felt more open and more friendly, welcome in my life, as though we were special people. And the village, we had complete access to the village headmen and that sort of thing. And you know, it was just, they welcomed us, and way one person described it is that we had sort of honored their village by coming and wanting to stay there, which we didn't have any real.
That's too loud. I couldn't hear what you were saying.
That we had honored their village by coming and living in their village. They couldn't understand why we would leave America to come and stay in this village. And we had to, you know, just say, well, we just came to see what you were like, and to let you know what we are like.
Yeah.
You know, and that's basically not too far off of why it was that we came. I do not know of any great plans that I had for my trip.
Right.
And I think that was pretty straightforward, and we would see what happened. And was what it was.
Did you ever tell them you were a volunteer?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't remember using that word, because I don't know that word in Laos.
I was wondering if they might have found it very difficult to understand what you were getting
about
out of this.
Yeah. No, it was strictly, and they would ask me. I mean, there was one really enormously, what I would call profound experience. We had, we had a big weapons carrier as a truck assigned to us, as well as a Jeep. And one of the guys called up there one time and said, we have this, the lumber for this school that needs to be delivered to the site. And I said, well, hell, I don't have anything to do. Why don't I just take it? So we had a trailer, one of these big trailers, army trailers, on the back, and so we loaded the thing up with wood and
put it in the back.
The weapons carrier with wood and so on, and didn't seem like enough wood, but we said that's all we had, so that was what we were going to. So we sort of knew where this village was, and the guy from the garden that worked with me, that I hired to work on the garden, went with me, and the Chow Meung sent one of his dignitaries with, who we knew pretty well, a young guy. So just myself and these two other guys took off. And we just took off cross-country and turned, and this is a dry area with a lot of logging trails and stuff like that. And we had these big maps that sort of showed where these things were, but really we were on our own, and we were asking people as we went and so on. And we got to this swollen stream type of thing, and I took the tarp or the canopy over the top of the truck, and I draped it over the front so it wouldn't pull the water up through the radiator and drown out the engine. Okay.
Yeah.
So I did that, and as the truck starts into the stream, this trailer behind just floats up, you know, because big tires and stuff like that, and just turns over.
Oh no!
And spews all this lumber into the stream. And so we're pulling the stuff, and we stop on the other side, and we load it all, you know, we go down and fish it all out, and we put it all back on. And by this time, you know, it's like 6 o'clock at night, and it's starting to get dark, and we didn't know where we were for sure. And we're a long way from where we're supposed to be, and we're also a long way from home. And so we just go on a little bit, and because of it's a logging trail, we're deathly concerned about, you know, a stump that might be sitting up fairly high that would just drag off the tie rods on the truck or some such thing and disable us completely. So one of the guys walked in front, and I drove very slow and stuff like that. We came into a clearing, and there were people cutting down trees, you know, working by light and stuff like this, probably about 8 o'clock. And it was a new village being made. And we drove into the middle of it, and we asked to see the head man, you know, that kind of thing. And the guy says, oh, yeah, he's over there. And he welcomed us up, and he's working on his nets and all this kind of stuff. Where are you going? What, you know, this kind of thing. And have you eaten and all that, that they would ask, and being very polite and all this stuff. And the whole evening was just, we sat around and talked. And they asked me all kinds of questions about America and about what was going on and that kind of thing. And people from the village brought in eggs, and we had some canned hams and stuff like that that we had brought along for our own food and stuff. And we opened these up, and oh, they liked that. And it was just this whole thing. And we slept there on the veranda. We're in this, in the guy's house, and the kids were all over the place looking at the stuff and in the truck. You know, you couldn't see any, I mean, there were footprints all over, and it was this huge festival. And it was just amazing, just an amazingly peaceful encounter. I don't know that I've ever been in anything like that, in which I never felt more at peace and safer than there. And it was just, there wasn't an ounce of anything. I mean, this war is going on in this country at this time, too. You know, I mean, there's a good chance that you know, this was between the road going from Pak Se to Savannah Ketch, so this is a main thoroughfare going through, and the incursion, I mean, you really couldn't drive this road, but we were off to the left of it, probably about a third of the way over to the Thai border, just out in the woods there. And we packed our things in the morning and left and went off and found this site and drove back. And it was just this, and we, you know, we thanked them, and it was this incredibly pristine Shangri-La type thing. I mean, I realized at that time that is not too far from the village of Rembrandt that I left, and this was here. You know, this kind of thing, as well as the one that we lived in back in La Compagne. And that this whole business, I mean, when you change the culture and the language and the way people look and the way people dress
and
the way
people,
what they eat and what, how they worship, you change everything. There is some commonality here, which was clearly dominated everything and could, you know, could make sense of all this stuff. And that was that concept of that community. I mean, people, I mean, it goes with the territory. If you come, you are welcome. You will be included. We do not judge you on the day. I mean, it isn't some Shangri-La. It really isn't, because it happened.
Yes, right? Yes.
And I grew up in something like that, so I know that happened. See? And so, you know, it suddenly just became this thing that this is the same thing. This is exactly what I know already. And it was like a great testimony to me to realize.
At its foundation, at least.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just the meaningful thing.
Yeah.
It gave this all meaning. That's what it meant to me to be from Rembrandt. It wasn't the idea of a small rural town. That doesn't make any meaning. But the idea of living there and having this kind of acceptance, you know, and differences
in
that
human
didn't
community.
Make a difference.
In a human community.
Absolutely. It had all to do with how we were interacting and people were being, you know, there and that sort of thing. And so I had this sort of a realization that this is the same. And so I just was overwhelmed by that whole notion that this is my village, which is the same village that I grew up in. And it's not some possessive thing other than the fact that, I mean, it would have been there whether I was there or not, whether I was aware of it or not.
Yeah.
But that is a, you know, that's the commonality. It was just, it was an amazing realization. And I said, this can be found anywhere.
Was this very new into your experience as
well? Well, I think it was, I was looking for it.
No, but I mean, in a chronological sense, where did you just arrive?
Oh, yeah,
fairly
we were
recently?
I'd probably been there. I was what they call an old hand by then, because there were other volunteers that had come in. Since
you're pretty instantly.
I already knew the land. Yeah, I was really versed. We were probably in the last, probably a year and something into my tour.
Okay.
And the cluster program, sort of that, you know, that we realized our pigs were wrong. They were white. They shouldn't have been white. They sunburned. You know, that kind of thing. They're the wrong kind of meat. I mean, you want fat. You don't want lean. They had genetic problems. You know, we had many of the of the males were born without anal openings, that kind of thing. So they hadn't really, they had interbred them so much in Laos, in Thailand, that we really didn't have a stock that we could cross with each other. They were just not. So we had those kind of problems. We had brucellosis breakouts, which means that they weren't either vaccinated before they came up, or they were so susceptible, or they were, you know, not healthy enough to ward it off or some such thing. The crossbreeding program was going pretty well, but we realized we had a defective boar, so we wouldn't do that anymore. A lot of the legumes and a lot of plants that we tried to raise on the garden area just didn't do very well. Let's see.
I mean, they're almost out of business.
Well, yeah, practically. And it was sort of running down, and I was doing this thing with the, schoolhouses and that sort of thing. It's just something to do. You know, I could do it because I had the time. And yet, the, you know, we still had animals on the site and so on, and we were raising them and stuff like that. But that was pretty routine, too, because we had food all lined up and so on.
Well, what do you mean by the thing with the high school?
Pardon?
You said you could still do that thing with the students? Isn't that what you just said?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what I was thinking. Or I don't know what I...
Oh.
I thought I
heard
you
say. You'll have to listen to that.
No, you were saying you could still do some things. Right?
No, I don't. I mean, it was like a lot of stuff that we were so enthusiastic about how this was going to change things. You know, there was a sequence here of things that happened, and I think it's worth noting. I mean, I remember thinking at the time, when I came to Laos, you know, I saw so many things that needed to be done.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have running water, they didn't have roads, they didn't have schools, they didn't have this and all this kind of stuff. So that did that for about the first 6 months, realizing that they just didn't have what I had. And then I realized that what they had was different than what I had in terms of what they needed and that sort of thing, and so I began to listen to them. So a lot of the stuff that I thought they needed when I first came, I threw out, and then I was listening to them a lot. Okay. So for the first year, that kind of seesaw went once, you know. And by the time I got in, I wasn't sure what we had to offer, period, beyond the experience of just seeing what happens. You know, there was a war going on. There were things happening. That there were diseases. There was childbirth. There was rains, water shortages, things that had to be immediately taken care of. And these are the things we kind of went into. So as things came up, we became incredibly sort of situational in our behavior. The plans and stuff were less important about, you know, geez, this year we're going to do this and stuff. Which drove the aid guys crazy.
Yeah, because
they want plans, and not only that, they want things.
They want a schedule, and they want the pins on the map.
Exactly, and they've got monthly reports to write and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly.
And you come back and say, well, we decided this instead.
We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
That's what we decided.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do? Well, I haven't decided that either, you know, that kind of thing. So at that point, you see, we were living, and I mentioned this earlier, because it became really clear that the government doesn't intercede much in the village. Rarely did the Chow Mun, for example, ever really go into the village. He had a house that was located quite a ways from the village.
Uh-huh.
And very rarely ever came down. In fact, I don't remember him ever coming in there. Unless he was absolutely invited for some ceremony of some kind. But as far as being a participant and a member of that, that he was not.
Uh-huh.
He was not a member of that that village of Lakonpeng. He was a functionary assigned there by the Lao government, and probably wished like hell that he had a different post. You know, young guy with a young wife and a couple of kids and that sort of thing, and was just putting in his time, so to speak. But
he was going to start there and work his
way up. Yeah, he was just beginning, and it was that kind of thing. So the idea that we were suddenly sort of the infrastructure, I mean, the American was really the infrastructure for the country, began to dawn on us. You know, if we didn't get things shipped down from Vientiane, they wouldn't be shipped. And we provided that through the Air America.
Was not interested in doing all
that. Yeah, this stuff would take ages. May not ever happen because, I mean, school books, school supplies, agricultural supplies just to support some, you know, vaccines and these programs were all we were substituting completely for the entire infrastructure of the Lao government. I mean, this guy would be assigned to Lac Ong Pang normally, and he would simply put in his time for 2 years, 3 years, whatever it was, until, oh, he's been down there, he needs to be moved. And so, but nothing would be necessarily, he wouldn't be held accountable for anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And here we were running these programs, and it was clear that that's what we were doing. And it had absolutely nothing to do with the law. If we didn't do it, it wouldn't happen.
Right.
This is a serious mistake on our part.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of different reasons. Okay? I mean, it's the kind of thing where we were worried about a flood in Vientiane and about what people are going to do about the flood, and we're airlifting in rice and that sort of thing, and the Laos are all going, hey, the flood's going to go down. Not to worry. We're worried about the cholera epidemic that's the result of all the toilets flooding and all this kind of stuff and the spread. Never happened. But we had all this stuff, the serum and everything was there.
Why didn't it happen?
It just never happened. Okay. You know what I mean? I mean, we're anticipating, we're thinking, we're planning, we're goal-oriented, we're incredibly want to get things done,
mm-hmm.
and we'll do what we're going to do, whether they're involved or not. And to the extent that we can bribe them, we can entice them, we can give them mm-hmm. these kinds of vehicles or some such thing, is the degree to which, you know, we've perhaps appear to have them have their cooperation. I realize that's all just, we're not influencing these people. They're just watching us.
Mm-hmm.
Put in this time. We built schools with no teachers in them. Because there was no teachers. You should have a school in every district, right? Yeah, but where's the teachers? Well, they hadn't graduated them from the school at Dandok, you know?
Uh-huh.
There weren't enough. And there would never be enough to put one in. Well, Lac Ong Pang had one, but there would never be enough. I mean, so we had lots of schools we were building. This is activity. Just like our PIC program was just not thought out. Didn't have time. You know, we even made it worse by, say, bringing in pigs that were not suitable for that area, that kind of thing. So that kind of thing.
Well, your goal was different from the greater American goal.
Well, I think, yeah, we had programs and stuff. Yeah, we were the end, we were sort of the implementers or the executioners, in a sense, of AID. They were having an enormous amount of problems, obviously, and that's why they let a contract to IVS to sort of implement their programs in the villages.
But I think that's true.
Yeah.
But I was also thinking that as you begin to listen more to the villagers, you have began to develop a completely opposite set of goals.
Well, it wasn't that. We just stopped goaling.
Well, okay, but
I mean, it's the kind of thing where the Lao would say, "What?" I mean, we'd walk in and say, "You know, what are you doing?" You know, "Jiao het yang," and they would say, "Ba het yang," which means I'm doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, "Well, you know, you're doing something. You know, you're reading, you're resting, you're doing something. No, I'm doing nothing." You know, that kind of concept is there,
mm-hmm.
and I never saw that before. I mean, you could actually literally just enjoy yourself and just not be any, you know, not going anywhere, and you're just kind of being there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a whole new idea for me. Okay? And that's what they spent a lot of their time. It was very easy living in Laos. And I mean, they had built into the culture for the kinds of, say, traumas that they had were pretty well set in. I mean, they did traumatize over the loss of their children and that sort of thing.
Of course.